Hey everyone, this is Mark from FMA Talk Live. Before we get started, I just wanted to remind you to go to Facebook and hit the like button for our Facebook page. Also, if you could please tell a friend or training partner about the show and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at hashtag FMA Talk Live. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Hey everybody, FMA Talk Live. Thanks again for tuning in. FMATalkLive.com is where you can go to check out all the information of our past shows and up-and-coming shows. And I don't know, we have just a vast array.
A vast archive.
Yeah. Also, we have links to places where you can buy stuff. We have our new Lacoste Tagai.
It will make guaranteed to make any sword bigger, stronger,
harder, longer.
Exactly.
You can check out our video online. We have our FMA Talk Live YouTube stream now, where we'll be doing live streams. We also are going to be archiving shows up there as well. So as we have time, we'll be doing that. And we have a tournament coming up. So, Fred, why don't you lay down all the knowledge.
Well, coming this May 28th, we're proud to host probably the first and best ever FMA tournament in the Minnesota region. You know, I can easily say that. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, because we thoroughly researched that.
You know, like, but, you know, we figured, you know, there's starting to be more than one or two schools around the area. And, you know, especially regionally, there's just not many opportunities to compete, you know, if you want to do this. In the past, we could kind of go out to Chicago, and every 2 years there's something, you know, there's the GSBA tournament in Wisconsin, but, you know, it'd be nice to have something local, and it'd also be nice to just add one more tournament to the scene. So we're hoping that, hey, you know, some of y'all who listen to our show and are regional, that you can come out and participate, have some fun. We're trying to do a laid-back format, so it's not going to have all the rigmarole of a full tournament. Our matches are going to be judged, but, you know, there's not going to be overall winners or not winners. It's just a little extra pressure to make sure that you don't completely be like, well, coast through a match.
We'll try to figure something out to make it feel like you won something.
We will have prizes, you know, for various things such as the best ki and the audience pick for a match. We're trying to do this really cheap. So right now, if you...
Affordable.
You know, right now, if you register, you pre-register before May, it's going to be a whopping $45. And if you want or are willing to judge, and we'd please judge, we'll take another $10 off so it'd be a complete total of $35. And that's for competition in all the events, as well as letting, you know, your friend, limit four friends and family come and watch you do your thing. You know, after May, it's going to shoot up to, I believe, $60.
$60, yep.
Per guy. But, you know, again, you know, please check it out. You know, hopefully participate and make some new friends.
So it's really easy to sign up for it. We made a link right on our homepage. If you go to PhilippineCombatArts.com, there's a huge link in the middle of the screen. Click on that. That'll bring you right to the event page where you can sign up. You can pay. You can take advantage of that $45, right? Yeah, that early yep. sign up offer. And then you can also, you'll get a link to all the forms. You'll get an email with all the instructions, a map to the dojang and everything else. And you know, it'll be great. Plus, we'll be looking forward to seeing people, hopefully see some new faces. And if you're coming from out of town and you need any information about hotels or anything like that, just make sure you get a hold of Fred or myself, and we'll do whatever we can to make sure that you can get here and you got a place to stay.
That's affordable. And one more thing, and probably the most important reason to come to this tournament. Our kind hosts, Master Joe and Agnes Espino, have promised to cater, well, not cater, sell Filipino food concessions. Now, the dilemma is, you know, we're going to tell them how many people have pre-registered, so if only three people or five people pre-register, imagine that. They might make food for only five people. So if you want to make sure that you get your food, pre-registered people will have their priority on getting food.
Yeah, this is a perennial issue with tournaments in general, but especially the... you know, the Filipino tournaments, because they're generally a smaller base of competitors, especially for these, you know, tournaments like this, which aren't national tournaments, and that people just kind of show up, which is great. I mean, we want you to show up, but
we kind of, we're guilty of that too. So.
But if, you know, if we're going to have, if we're going to be roping other people into doing stuff and volunteering their time and everything, it's nice to have that pre-registration. Yeah. So even if you let us know for sure and you can kind of commit to coming, let us know ahead of time. So there's that. And then what else we got going on? If you're going to be up here and you want to train FMA, you can always get a hold of us again, PhilippineCombatArts.com. John Bednarski down in Chicago, the other host who's not on the line right now, he had to leave, but he's going to be back on when we talk to Professor Hakano, who's our special guest today, actually. So for those of you who are just dying to learn everything you can about the history of FMA in the Philippines, we got a good show for you there. But you can check him out at Midway Kodokan or Three Treasures School of Arms. I got it right this time.
Ah, nice. Well, it's because he went with Treasures instead of trying to go for all the foreigners. No longer Tatlong
Pusaka.
Pusaka.
Yeah, I think that's what I was telling Pusaka. Anyway, so check that out on Facebook. And then you can also check us out on Facebook, FMA Talk Live, and then our Twitter page as well, FMA Talk Live. And you can get updated on when the shows go live on iTunes and Stitcher. If you have Stitcher or you're listening to us on Stitcher, you can check us out on iTunes, however that works. So,
awesome.
So there's that. So without further ado, we'll have our special guests coming up. And just to let you know, we are talking to Professor Hakano from the Philippines. So expect glitches and expect at least for us to drop the call twice, maybe three times.
Three or four times.
So we'll try to edit it and put it together, but just like every call we've ever had with the Philippines, there will be issues that I'm expecting. So just bear with us.
Why are you making me do this?
He figured it out. That was pretty impressive.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, well, John,
it's Felipe Jr. period Hakano.
Okay.
You're more advanced on Skype than I am. I don't even have a Skype account. I have one, but I don't use it. So
I'm only doing this for business. But there is cross-pollination, though, between CLOT and heavy pollination between CLOT and Eskrimo. They share similar rhythms. They share similar footwork patterns.
Well, it's one of those things, though, at least for me, and especially with modern arnis and a lot of the joint...
Try adding them because the call just failed. I'm going to get rid of them here.
Well, for me, the footwork... There is some footwork depending on who you're watching do Eskrima. There's certainly that, but there's no weapons, and CLOT that...
Well, it's also like, is this an ancient pollination or is it like most things, like Remy Presas meeting Wally J and suddenly Eskrima has a million and two joint locks?
Yeah,
you know, exactly. Is this a lot more like, is CLOT really cross-pollinated in the 1800s, or was it when Leo Gahe was in the 60s hanging over in Indonesia?
Was there like a Dose Pares Eskrima club in Salat land where they all got together and all of a sudden you have judo and Eskrima together?
But that's one of the beauties of synthesis, which is one of the elements of Indo-Malay martial art.
Definitely. It's one of those things. What FMA is now is almost as heavily influenced by the modern worldwide market than what it is or historically is or hasn't been.
Exactly.
And it's
that's
like
upper element to it.
And that's one of our dilemmas when we try to teach people FMA and they're like, well, FMA, where's your, flow drill number five? Where's your heaven six count? Where's this, that, and the other? Where's your hubud lubud? Where's your joint lock flow? And it's like, we don't have one.
Expectation.
Well, and where's your groin kicks and your eye gouge set?
And then the worst part, and that would be one thing if they were open to the other stuff. But when it comes to like, well, no, we don't have that. But instead, let's fight. Let's spar. Let's play. Oh, that's not FMA.
Well, no, because that would be in the streets.
Yeah.
We can't bring it to the level of realism, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, it's either the streets or you guys are jerks. You guys are just jockey jerks.
Deadly to spar, but then how do you learn it?
Oh, no, that's what practical arts would say.
But it's not even that. I think, you know, people are open to the sparring because the way we do it, we build people up from a, you know, from a small level. It's the boring, repetitive, learn. You got to learn the footwork. You got to hit the tire. You got to learn these, you know. You got to learn your
but that's an all 100-0 arts.
Footwork, you know, your elastico. You got to learn these things.
But that's in all arts. If you start out, let's say, in Katori Shinto Ryu, one of the older actually documented rules, you'll sit there and you'll do three strikes for several months with a wooden sword before you get to do anything else.
No,
and have to learn all the bowing and everything else. So it's
I don't dispute that every good art has basics that you should learn before you do anything else. The dilemma is, and it's kind of like the old boxing adage. You go into the boxing gym and all you do for a week is learn to jab.
Yeah.
You know, and not because after the week your jab will be good and you can move on. It's just like, too much. And that's kind of the way it's gotten better with us, because we used to just throw people right into the mix.
Yeah, you can't do that.
You know, and at least now we're more basics oriented and we wean people in. And that'll keep the people who are interested in actually learning what we do. But we still get guys like Martin or whoever who, I want to learn Kali Knife.
Yeah.
And it's like, where's my collar? You know, why are we doing all this other stuff? Why are we hitting a tire? What?
Yeah.
How will the tire make my Kali knife better?
I need that technique that's going to work.
Yeah, and then drill.
And then I'm going to look at you and then try to break it down to see, you know, how would that fail, or would that really work? You know, it's all, you get those people that come in that are constantly kind of looking you over, like, I don't know if that's really, you know, realistic.
My Kali knife fails against my Kali gun.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is very popular in the Philippines, I might add.
Oh, exactly. Well, it's kind of like the whole, you know, like, let's be real about where does Eskrima fall into the cultural pantheon of the Philippines. Right now, it's better than 30 years ago. But right now, it's like, it's that shit kids do in gym class.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's volleyball. Like, how many adults go on?
A lot of Filipinos.
Do a lot of volleyball, you know.
Yeah.
It's a volleyball league.
And it's one of those things, like, you know. Even my dad, growing up, before it got popular, because he never did the high school thing, because he immigrated here in the 60s, he was like, look, Eskrima, it's for poor people and for people to play, but if you really want to, going back to the gun thing, real men get guns when you can, you know, and that's kind of the culture there.
It's also very similar in Thailand. Thai boxing is actually looked down upon in Thailand.
No, yeah, no Thais do Thai boxing. They're all Khmer, or they're all Lao or whatever.
Right, but they have their martial art of Kabong that they actually hold in esteem that they practice, which is different than Thai boxing.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. So it's that's the epoch kind of where we're at. And I agree with you. It's like, why couldn't you get a real skill like fix a car? Why would you do a scream on?
So are we still attempting to contact Prof. Bot, or what's the deal?
Try calling him again.
Well, I'll let you guys call him this time.
And we did eventually get a hold of Professor Akano. It was 5 a.m. in the Philippines, and he was gracious enough to get up early and talk to us before going to his classes at the university. And we catch him here kind of in almost maybe a couple minutes into his explanation, comparing the Philippines and the perception of FMA over there versus the perception of FMA and the marketing of it here in the United States.
An art which is foreign to you and which you are making indigenous to you. Okay? It's you guys indigenizing the Filipino martial arts. So if an American FMA, in some of the discussion forums I was on, everybody said, an American FMA sounds like a contradiction in terms. Oh, really? Tell that to the guys who founded the American JKA Association, the American JKA. You know, those guys big on the karate scene, Japan Karate Association, or the Americanized Shotokan Karate, right?
Yeah.
They took the Japanese Shotokan Karate and popularized it within the U.S., and they made it approach something that appealed more a wider mass base of American students. What's wrong with that? Nothing.
Well, though, I would
How
say...
How about the American Taekwondo?
I would say one bit of pushback on that issue.
right?
Compare, because a lot of us have done other, arts such as Taekwondo or whatever. Here in the U.S., there's a concerted effort to be like, we're going to, here's the physical art, but we're going to try make some effort to do homage to the culture where this art came from.
Of course.
Whereas a lot of times when you go to FMA classes in the U.S., it's like, culture, that's...
And once again, our connection dropped, but we resume it again shortly.
We're recording. We're back. So, all right, so we were saying, with the, when the culture is kind of thrown out the window and it's just becomes we were hitting the stick on the head.
Now, did we just get to the part about Black Belt Magazine?
I don't know.
Because I figure our audiences need to hear more about Black Belt Magazine back in the day.
But I had several issues. Okay. But, for better or for worse, Black Belt was one way for me to look at how martial arts was being, Filipino martial arts was being marketed and taught abroad. Okay. And yeah, it's been a marketing issue about the pragmatic use of martial arts. And it's not just FMA, but in the martial arts media, there's always been this big thing about how to use everything you've got, right? Mm. So there's always in the magazines, there's an ongoing debate about those who want to keep everything strict and traditional, do it like you do in Japan. And then there's this thing about adapting it to the local setting. And with FMA, I think it was easier to see how it was applied in different urban contexts, whether in the Philippines or in the U.S., whichever city you're working in, if it's Manila or in New York, whereas with some of the empty hand martial arts, there's a degree of specialization, there's a greater degree of specialization you can see in the empty hand arts. Wing Chun, for instance, okay, versus the Northern style martial arts. And so that kind of debate pretty much also shapes how people see FMA as well. And reading some books that came out from the U.S., in which you find the second generation of practitioners, they were so enthusiastic about seeing how in the FMA, the instructor threw out all of the classical stuff and just gave him the good stuff, the direct, no bones, whatever, straight to the hardcore, no more flowery stuff. Okay, fine. It was the marketing thing, direct to the point, no flowery stuff, no flowery movement, no fluff, there. What the Chinese would call flowery fists and embroidered feet. Yeah? Fancy kung fu, that does not mean anything. Yeah, there you go. Mm. So, it was watching it from abroad. They said, okay, so this is how many of the next generation of FMA practitioners see our art. It's very practical, but the cultural context is missing. Mm-hmm. When and how did we do these arts? And I think one key element there is the fact that with the Chinese, the Japanese, and to a large extent the Korean arts, okay, and even the Indian martial arts that are making some news right now, there is the cultures that brought these martial arts there have very long literary tradition that's relatively untouched by foreign influence. Mm-hmm. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. China, for instance, has a long, long literary tradition, and you can find manuals for martial arts going all the way back 17th century. 16th century, for instance, and some very, very much older. You have a philosophical corpus materials going all the way back, about the time of Christ and even older, right? Yeah. Archaeology discourse that. Same for Japan, right? Although given that the Japanese tradition, feudal Japan, China was the cultural model, even though they were always fighting with China. Same goes for Korea, right? And so there's this sense of
Korea, though, going back. I would also give the pushback that, I took a lot of Asian history classes in college, and one of my professors gave a lot of pushback on the idea that Japanese arts were extremely coded, and that a lot of the push, particularly for Japanese and Korean arts, are more modern than what their propaganda says. And like with judo being the first art you know, that they tried to promulgate around the world and were kind of sketchy on the background. And so it also speaks to the influence of strong governmental control and help of getting these stories out and creating a narrative.
Yeah. Well, that's like Gumdo with Korea, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of like a... Is that art 100 years old?
Yeah, Taekwondo still has that, you know, criticism too. Is like, is this really an ancient art from the Kwans back in the 1,000 days ago? Or is this really just Okinawan karate rebranded?
Sure.
And many Koreans do agree that Taekwondo is basically karate that's been rebranded. I hear that from native Koreans too.
Mm.
Okay? But we're talking about Japan, for instance. When I'm referring to the older martial ryu, things like Tenshin Shoden, Katori Shinto Ryu, which has its own set of written material, members only who could read, and there's only a recent effort to translate some of them. Now, things like those. The older arts, not the more recent ones karate. Yeah. With karate, on the other hand, you'd have to go to Okinawa and look at the older sources. So, perfect. I agree with the pushback, but it also applies to the more modern martial arts, the older ones, the Bujutsu from Japan. They have a literary tradition.
Yeah.
But in the Philippines, most of our literary tradition has been foreign influence, at least the written one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Many of the written forms were influenced by, you know, Spanish language. What we have in terms of our surviving literature is mostly orally transmitted literature, and a lot of, you know, non-Filipinos are still unfamiliar with this whole thing. Many of these are being transcribed, so you could reach now a reading audience, but the original transmission was mostly by hearing. The performers, the chanters, would sing this to the audience. Somebody who's an interest begins learning from them, and it's memorized. Not completely untouched, but it's memorized. So you see, there's a very big difference in that kind of mindset, right? That affects the way even the FMA are transmitted. Even until today, FMA is transmitted primarily by an oral tradition, right? The literary traditional backup to the literary side to FMA is not there. It's not in the same kind of literary dimension that the Chinese arts have or the Japanese arts have. You know, the super secret transmission of scrolls that are written in by Bain, that when I give that to you, you are now the next grandmaster of the style and I can retire, go gardening in peace.
That's how it.
Too many martial arts movies.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, Professor Akana, just hold on 1 second. John dropped. Let me just get him back on the call. Just pause one second.
Oh, sure, no problem.
Thanks.
All right, no problem.
You can get a glass of water. You've been dumping a lot of knowledge here.
It's okay.
That's interesting. Usually, it used to pause the guest when we would try to call before.
Right.
Looks like it's doing it silently in the
background. Ah, you're back.
That's nice. I like that. No ring.
You want to turn your camera on?
So
what?
Oh, are you still on the phone? Or?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay.
So, you know, but now... You know, we have video cameras and we have, you know, people creating curriculums and doing, you know, a little more detailed lineages and trying to kind of, you know, I know, you know, Fred and I we at least try to record everything that we do so that we can at least do our best to recreate it. And if somebody has a question, we can give them the best answer and the most accurate one that we know.
Right. And that's the way it should be, actually. So, in effect, what's happening is you're creating a new literary tradition, one that's not necessarily pen and paper or ink and scroll or, for crying out loud, carved stones or whatever. But it's more iconic now.
John's favorite medium, carved stone.
That's how John works.
Yeah, yeah, no, if you saw his draft of his book that he's working on, and people are like, why is it taking... Because he can only carve so fast.
He can only buy one at a time, and it has to be has to be shipped by flatbed.
And then watch out when you watch out when you carve a letter wrong and the editor sends it back to you.
That too. My editor is correct. I tell ya.
Here's an example from... I'll share with you a story from one of my friends who was doing his master's thesis on Philippine martial arts history. Okay? Now, you know, he was going around collecting all of the oral stories because, frankly, there was very little in the way of written history. So what he was doing was contacting as many older generation and second generation practitioners as he could find and record their memories, transcribe them, put them together into a coherent format. So oral history turning into recorded history. His advisor was asking him, can't you find any written text? And he said, no, I can't. And he asked me, why not? Well, isn't there any some sort of written hidden archive repository? So when he was telling me about it, he said, well, you know, that sort of thing exists only in the movies. Too many black belt theater, Saturday morning, type of kung fu theater, sorry, too much kung fu theater. Okay? Yeah. No, that there's no such thing here, you know, that again, that hidden written scroll on bamboo leaves written in Baybayin that I give it to Fed, to Mark, and to John, and lo and behold, they are now the next generation masters of Bokano Jutsu or whatever. No, it doesn't work that way. Sorry, now and the secret's out now. Guess we'll have to go back to carving stones.
Yeah. Well, you know, John's just trying to push the stone industry here. That's his plan to fix the economy. All new stone carving industry.
You know, since the Philippines doesn't have a Shaolin monastery that, you know, has the, you know, written and artistic traditions, you know, behind it, you know, you're actually completely correct on that in that regard. So all the oral histories are being recorded as we speak. And do you think that with these oral histories, people would be surprised at, you know, what is spoken of or what is actually discussed in these histories?
Oh, very much so. Sometimes because it counters previously recorded oral history, right? You have examples where there's this first generation Filipinos who went over there and gave this story about transmitting the art from some remote village down in the Philippines, when the truth of the matter was the man learned from his uncle and before he went over to the US. Yeah? So for some reason, people do create a... Well, it's branding purposes. If people create a mystical story, and the truth
narrative
is sometimes more pragmatic. Yeah,
so,
kind of, along that line. And usually, you know, most of these stories, I've had a discussion too with, was this friend of mine, Thomas Green. He's an anthropologist and specializing in martial arts. Used to be a faculty member at University of Texas. We were going back and forth online about the hero narrative, something like Campbell's work on mythology. There's a psycho story here because every martial arts master, every life story you see about martial arts training, martial arts mastery, online or in printed form, follows a particular pattern. In folklore, you have what we call the hero narrative. So when it's a creative storytelling, it's not far off the mark. It's a connecting thread, if available, to his master being a survivor of World War II. Usually that's a very common narrative. And then what the master is doing now. Okay? It's a very common pattern. If you look at other hero stories, Arthurian mythology, for instance, okay, even the Shaolin monastery, worldwide you find a very similar pattern. They're trying to connect you to something historical. Right, so that's the problem. That in that sense, perhaps since it's mostly oral tradition, the problem then is in the West, you'd want to see concrete evidence, and it's always defined as a written text. But the only concrete evidence here is people's memories. Hmm. The thing with oral history now is how consistent is this across a wide group of people. But we have to remember that these are people's memories. That's the thing.
Hmm.
Okay. Oh, my video disappeared. All right, I went back to video. It ended for a while. Okay. So I hope that makes sense with the in regard to, you know, this whole historical issue about what FME is and all that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, you know, well, the history side of it, you know, just any kind of logical, you know, look at some of the claims that are out there,
yeah.
You know, it gets to the idea of what is the Philippines. And I think that's also, I was just, before I got here, I was reading an article my sister gave me on Filipino food in America and why does it struggle to find roots. And, you know, if you come to the U.S., there's very few Filipino restaurants and very little access to outsiders, aside from local, you know, the Filipino community. And one of the dilemmas is regionalism, the fact that even though for how many hundreds of years there was an island, group of islands called the Philippines, but, you know, even today, how much in common does a Cebuano have with a Tagalog that they will admit to? You know, and even in my own family, because my mom's Tagalog and my dad's Bisayan, there's certain tensions in there. And we're trying to make this nice, wonderful, unified history like supposedly Japan has that says, oh, no, from ancient times, we have this preserved art. Well, from ancient times, that guy didn't talk to that guy. So, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, when did this story start forming? Did it start forming in ancient times or because you had a new article submission to Black Belt Magazine or...
Well, and if you look at FMA politics, it kind of follows along those lines anyway. You know, it doesn't take long for one master to break off from the system, or one student to go off and start his own, or two masters were working together, and now all of a sudden they're rivals. And...
Well, it's also that thing too. Like,
sounds
there's
familiar.
this push to forget the fact that hey, even the Philippines was not. You know, depending where you were, not everyone was pro-American in World War II. You know, towards the end, a lot of people converted thanks to the nice behavior of Japanese people. But, you know, a lot of times our history, at least as far as the West and FMA, isn't as pretty as a lot of people would like to think. And that was one of those reasons that book I was raving about not so long ago was really interesting to me. It was just like, oh, here's a period opinion of what does a local Filipino who lived through the Philam War think of the Americans? And it wasn't super horrible because it was like, I forget the exact date of when he wrote his memoir, but it was definitely a lot different than the way a lot of Filipino history would is currently saying what a Filipino relationship is with the West.
That one about that recent book about the Samar later history.
Yes.
That one, that memoir, I've seen a copy of that in the local bookstore, so next on the list.
Yeah.
But you know, things about this, considering this, how was the Philippines imagined here and abroad? You mentioned the constant regionalism, and it's not going to go away, right? The thing is here, the Philippines as a construct, I was just online with friends of mine at one of the other fora. And you know, the Philippines as a construct was imagined only around roughly, the Katipunan era.
Yeah.
We're talking about the man named, been talking about Apolinario Mabini, the brains of the revolution against the Americans. There has to be a clear distinction that has to be made. In the constitution that he wrote, I have the copy of the document. Well, this one is could you guys see this?
Yeah. What's the...
There you go.
Republic
Mabini.
The title is in Tagalog. They're ang Republika ni Mabini. These are four of these political documents. The one that was interesting was in Espanol. It says, Programa Constitucional de la Revolución Filipina. Okay? Definitions. De los Filipinos. Okay? Son Filipinos. las personas nacidas en el territorio de la República Filipina. Dos, hijos de padre o madre filipinos, aunque hayan nacido fuera de la República. Tres, los extranjeros que hayan obtenido papa de naturaleza. Cuatro, los que en Celia hayan ganado vecindad en cualquier pueblo de la República, which means Filipinos, people those born in the Republic of the Philippines. Two, children of one parent, either one father or one mother Filipino, even if they were born outside. Three, foreigners who have completed their naturalization papers. Four, foreigners that are not naturalized but have made their residence in any part of the Philippines. The idea of the Philippines was already being, imagined already at the time. It was already seen as a national entity. What is the definition of the Philippines in Mabini's work? Okay, Titulo 2 de la República Filipina, Artículo 20. La República Filipina es la reunión de todos filipinos domiciliada en el territorio comprendido por las islas de Luzon, Visayas y Mindanao, el archipiélago de Jolo y demás islas adyacentes comprendidas dentro de la región conocida de antiguo con el nombre de las Islas Filipinas. The Republic of the Philippines is composed of all the Filipinos who live within the territory created by the islands of Luzon, Visayas, and Mindanao, the archipelago of Jolo, and the other nearby islands that have been recognized from time immemorial from the name Islas Filipinas. And then there's an interesting note about the current U.S. territories, the Marianas, the Carolinas, and others. At the time, these were held by the Spaniards. So, las Islas Marianas, las Carolinas y demás sujetas al gobierno español en la Oceania formarán parte independiente de la República Filipina si voluntariamente girían causa común los filipinos para conseguir su independencia. And the islands of the Marianas and the Carolinas and all others held by the government of Spain in Oceania may be included in the Republic of Filipinas if they voluntarily join or identify with the cause of the revolution in order to attain independence. Now, this was a revolutionary document, but you have one of those earliest clear statements of a political entity called Filipinas. And this was imagined by a Tagalog speaker. And from then on, you can see that since it was from one ethnic group, Tagalog speaker, you have all the consequences there. Did the Visayans agree with this or not? See? May the Mindanao people agree with this or not?
Oh, yeah.
Because the indigenous peoples, the Moros living in Mindanao, certainly did not agree with it.
Yeah.
There's another very fascinating book, Making Moros, written by an American in Moroland. That's what they called Mindanao then. Okay? The American military administration was very strong then in various parts of Mindanao, especially Jolo, Sulu, not the others. And the governor, the military governor, took a more positive approach. Instead of doing a military approach, he did an economic one. First, by displaying American military and tech and other forms of technological advancement. Okay, one of the, and then by providing incentives for people to participate instead in an economy. He would have them organize trade fairs, markets, with the proviso was when they go to the market to buy and sell goods, they shouldn't be killing one another because of the interethnic rivalry. More or less, they fairly followed suit because they found that it was more to their advantage to outdo each other in trade rather than outdo each other in killing. The thing was, when the government, this was going to be transferred to civilian hands, to the assembly, legislative assembly, to the Commonwealth government, the chieftains, the Datu and the Sultans protested. They would rather continue under the American rule at the time, which is a very telling, a very, very telling statement. And it's, you know, that's another layer to the complex narrative called Philippine history.
Well, you know, I would also posit that, like a lot of people, not just at that time, not just non-Christian tribes, were very wary of going under the rule of a bunch of Tagalogs in Manila.
Correct. Because, you know, this, the there always had been, even before the Spaniards came, there was always that inter-ethnic competition in trade and in warfare. And they would be very worried. The outsider, the foreigner, seems like a safer bet, because the other guy, the guy that you knew very well, is the guy you only know all too well.
Exactly.
And so you're going to have problems. But the guy you don't know, you have a reason to trust because you don't know him that well yet. It's one of those paradoxes. And it's not just the same, it's not only here, but in many other cultures as well.
Oh, yeah.
And oddly, the American approach in Mindanao in that regard is actually a lesson learned here in the U.S. that we don't talk about after our Civil War.
Yeah.
Because
That's
in the South here, we had much regionalism in the United States in the late 19th century. And after the Civil War, we had a lot of political violence and killing and problems. And it was actually that time period during Reconstruction that they actually decided that they were going to take a more economic approach to everything in reconstructing the South in that regard. So the lessons learned with that obviously were applied in the southern Philippines as well. It's actually quite fascinating. So there is a bit of shared history, I guess you could say, in that regard.
Well, not to mention the fact that the entire Filipino government, including the treatment of non-Christian tribes, was modeled after the BIA here in the U.S., or the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Indian Affairs, yes.
We had the parallel bureau here, and you know that's where part of our own university's colonial roots come from. In fact, the Department of Anthropology originally also was one of those training grounds for future civil servants working across the archipelago. You should have seen our old curriculum with all of the antique labels going all the way back to the early 20th century. We had to do a lot of curricular revision over the years in order to update it and make it more indigenized. But there you go. If you try to lump Mindanao history into Philippine history, that's another can of worms, because the perception of the country as a republic in the Philippines was different from both ends. The archipelago, there's a Yakan. Interestingly, their perception now of the Republic, the Philippines, as it stood, at least at the time I was talking to my guru, is that it was a kind of mixed feelings. You see, for one thing, my teacher told me in very personal terms, it was the best bet they had to intervene in the countless instances of internal conflict. You needed an outside force. Right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, he also said to me, the government could do a better job in taking care of the indigenous peoples. So, you know, there's always this, a little bit of both mixing this. And I find many people also share that sentiment, right? Even in the middle of, you know, one example of that desire for the government to do better is the ongoing discussion on the Bangsamoro Basic Law. That's a controversial issue in here. Not everybody, many of those who spoke out against it were prominently from Visayas and Luzon. Interestingly, within Mindanao, many of the non-Magindanao said, we don't really need a BBL because wherever, where we are, we're doing quite well, which is also true, right? So, you know, that sort of thing, this sort of tensions, this sort of dimensions, that's what adds to this complex whole we call Philippine culture. We're looking from the outside, looking at it, far enough period of time, it seems like a nice big unified whole. But when you get in up close, you find it's not. There's lots of tensions, there's a lot of fluidity, there's a lot of messiness. And you know, that reflects people's daily lives. Personal lives are never really all that neat either. Neither are communities. How much more they are the lives of nations.
Exactly.
Right? And that will affect our perception of Filipino martial arts, defining what is a Filipino martial art, and defining what is Filipino martial arts history, trying to thread all your way all throughout these contexts.
And then you then you throw in the confusion of what the Western markets are doing, and if we get the hot jumble of mess that we have now.
But you know since you mentioned that Western market interest, that's the nicest example would be the rebranding of Filipino martial arts. Instead of using the name Kali Arnis Eskrima, especially the first one, Kali being the most controversial name of all, you have the impact and bladed weapons. So make it nice and generic sounding. And you know, you have to, one of the most recent trends in this cultural perception of the arts has been the trend towards using more and more terminology that's borrowed from this more high-tech, make it look sexier and high-tech.
Yeah, militarized.
For instance, edge and impact weapons.
Yeah.
Yes? Oh yeah, the militarization factor isn't very far away. And also the techno speak. Edge and impact weapons training seminar. See, so instead of learning pattern drills, you are learning templates.
Yeah.
Instead of active drills, feeder defender drills.
It's tactical.
It makes it, tactical. And just waiting for, I did see an ad for a tactical ice cream maker. Huh?
Ooh.
One of the coolest things I saw in the big
ad. That is literally tactical.
Yeah.
Right.
But we still suffer from, you know, a bit of a marketing thing, because bladed impact weapon still doesn't roll off the tongue like Krav Maga.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what would you rather eat, a Holstein or a Black Angus? I mean, that's, you know, you got...
or a cow or a Black Angus.
Cow or a Black Angus. Like, well, I want Black Angus. That sounds great. You know, I'd take a martial art called Black Angus. That sounds tactical. You know,
the tactical way to eat steak.
Exactly, tactical steak.
That's a longhorn, baby.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, that's the thing is we still kind of, I feel like we, Filipino martial arts, yeah, that's good. But then people are like, well, what's Filipino? You know what I mean? So there's...
Yes.
Well, I definitely have seen some pushback in the West where you see guys take off the Filipino martial art label just because it's like, I'm not Filipino and I want some space in this area where I can be legitimate and do what I do, which has something to offer and has quality. But because if I keep the FMA route, the only way I can go is to be the exotic art, whereas... You know, I'm not an exotic, the quote per se exotic person, so I have to rebrand this so people will give me time of day.
You know, that same thing that you mentioned, Fed, I as an outsider looking at the martial arts scene over there, I've seen that happen following in print media and online. This is precisely the same thing that happened to karate and judo and taekwondo, and then later on the Chinese martial arts, the kung fu sort of thing. So you have an Americanized form of Wing Chun out there, which incorporates a fair amount of grappling in the arts and then some responses to modern-day weapons. There's this Americanized forms of karate, for good or for worse, whatever you look at it. But the performance aspect is a very big deal, obviously, right?
Yeah.
Then, of course, then you have the Americanized karate systems that came from Hawaii. Yeah? They've been part of the local martial arts for so long. Kenpo, Karate Bo, Kajukenbo, to name two. Right? Whatever people may think of them, they're pretty effective, and they are obviously very much in line with an American way of thinking. Very pragmatic, the primary theme is efficiency, etc. All of which are things that are historically handed down within American culture.
Mm.
Having the end point in mind. So, obviously, a lot of martial arts will be restructured along the line. With the discovery, however, of the traditional ways to interpret traditional karate forms, and the new stuff coming up with, finally, how the Okinawans actually did practice karate, for instance, and more of a greater emphasis on grappling, you see the same thing happening all over again, trying to make it more efficient and to fit local scenes. Even our own style of Arnis had to undergo modifications when it was being transmitted over there. My teacher, Guru Elmer, was teaching 6-foot guys, and he's 5-foot something. So obviously, some of the technique sequences in the videos they gave me of their training, they had to change. Why? He was defending against bigger guys bigger than himself. So, you know, the evolution continues. And recognizing also this other stuff, the historical part. Well, it's not just FMA, but many of the traditional arts. It's an ongoing thing. And a lot has to do with American, how you guys see American culture as such, the emphasis on particular themes, for instance, like being pragmatic, like being direct to the point. Inevitably, any cultural art that gets into that scene is going to be transformed there, for good or for worse, however you might perceive it.
So I guess I got a quick question, you know, talking about marketing and how it's being perceived. So, you know, we have a pretty good handle on the U.S., but in the Philippines, you know, when you're looking at the groups there that are popular and, you know, which Filipino martial arts groups, you know, seem to really resonate with, you know, the students and get a lot of students, are they branding it as FMA or is it something else?
Well, they are consciously branding it as FMA in here. Part of that process has been the growth in nationalism. It's partly a nationalistic thing. We did undergo a period in our pop culture when a lot of us idolized more Western and other foreign forms of popular culture. But as Fed puts it, the pushback comes from a large part of pushing back comes also from Filipino martial arts. By the rebranding of being proud of being Filipino, that's one of the biggest hooks that you have here. Now, it only now remains to see how well does the association treat its members so they have a reason to keep on going within their style. In that regard, perhaps one of the best organized groups, but the best organized styles, of which there are several groups that are pretty cohesive, has been Modern Arnis. You know, in the Philippines too, when you say Arnis, Filipino martial arts, you know, that's what most people think. But just to give you an idea of how recent this was, I have a 1987 Tagalog English book. The author, the translator, was appropriately named Father John English.
Ah, nice.
He was a priest. Yep. Yeah, nice name, huh? Irony.
So
I looked
well.
Up, when I got hold the book, I looked up the term Arnis. Yes, Arnis made it to the entry dictionary. What was its definition? Filipino form of karate. What?
Ah,
what am I just
saying? Nice.
I'm not kidding. Because martial arts in the 1980s and 70s was mostly associated with karate. The Arnis guys had a uphill battle promoting and saying this is a unique indigenous martial art. We're having more success now because of the internet, because you put up on YouTube, and because it's the constant telling of the narrative that you begin to see people, hey, wait a minute, there's something to this after all. See?
Okay.
And that's one of the more fascinating directions that it did go. And that's why the branding is in line with this. In the 1970s too, there was that resistance to foreign forms of pop culture, and there's an encouragement by Filipino artists to begin becoming more aggressive in promoting their songs. So for instance, if pop music was primarily top 40, there was a movement called OPM, Original Filipino Music. Rock and roll groups began to promote songs that were written mostly in Tagalog. Okay, at least this is for Metro Manila. So with that pushback in from the 70s comes a whole new space for Filipino pop culture to begin expanding. The government rule at the time was that in reaction to all of this pop culture mess, all radio stations should play at least this many minutes per hour of original Filipino compositions, which created a demand. Yes, back in the 70s. Which created a demand for more Filipino compositions to be played on the airwaves. The irony of it was, many of the Filipino songs were thinly disguised resistance.
The minute you said that, I had to do some recall here. It's like, oh, 70s, right. Marcos era, right. And all the protest songs.
That's
that came.
The time.
They're
thinly disguised. So, Arnis was also something like a resistance to the marketing of the foreign martial arts of karate, and judo being very popular at the time. Taekwondo was entering the scene in the 70s and is becoming well known throughout the school system. And so that was the position Arnis found itself in, a position of having to compete against these arts. When you seek the wider context of Filipino pop culture, create and artists creating their own space for the local consciousness, it was the same with Arnis. That's why, for instance, Ernesto Presa's gym in Quiapo, the combatant gym, was very iconic for the period of time because he had the guts to go at this and operate a full-time gym. And he succeeded, location-wise, of course, and then his branding, the marketing style. He was aggressive in promoting the art among the Leos, among the military. And he succeeded so much so that his gym became a space where other Filipino martial arts masters would come in and, you know, they were actually invited to teach a class or two there by Ernesto Presas. And that's how he made the connection and network with so many people.
So it kind
Grandmaster Ben Lev.
Kind of the way you're describing how, you know, modern FMA, or at least the revisioning and popular, it seems to be very much in line with how karate and like how we talked about earlier, the governmental helps, because why did Japan want to brand karate and judo to compete with foreign arts? Because they felt too much baseball was getting too popular, so they wanted to promote their local sport. And so, and so it sounds like the same kind of thing was happening with that our arts flourish with governmental help. They don't flourish when we're left to our own vices.
There is this other thing, though. The analogy, though, with Japan has to be taken into context with the militarization that occurred shortly after the Meiji Restoration. Judo and kendo, the modern arts, were popularized in the schools. One, the curriculum was more systematic. Two, the way they were practiced, it was safer for more young people. And three, it was a perfect breeding ground for a very militant form of Shinto, or Shintoism. So that's what the government found very, very useful. With the Philippines, except it was only in the context of pop culture that you had governmental support, but otherwise, very little to none, except maybe for the practice of recruiting, inviting Filipino martial artists to teach for law enforcement and for military. But that was often done at the initiative of local commanders. To create the potential, to create a unique AFP
We're starting to lose you.
I think we just froze completely.
Was there, but it was never fully realized.
Okay.
You have only different initiatives, like the current but that is the initiative of the Marines, the Marine Commander. It's not a systematic effort within the AFP to make it.
We're starting to break up with your call, and we probably should let you go too. You need to get to. I know you need to get to the
work at some point. And we're starting to see you now, and that was kind of our thought. Is like when we can see your face fully, that's probably time to let you go.
I know the sun's up.
All right.
So thank you very much. It's been very interesting, and thanks for the info. It's good talking to you again.
We got to do this more regularly because it's always fun, and it's just one of those things to have a stock like every 4 months or six, however many, how often we do it. We always know that when you're on the show, it's going to be a good show. So
yeah, we got some good information.
Thanks, guys.
All right, and we promise next time we'll have only one technical difficulty.
Yeah, just one. One big one, but it'll be one.
All right, well, we'll let you go, and thanks again.
Yeah, maraming salamat.
We'll chat with you soon.
All right, see you. I'm looking forward to talking to you guys again.
No, all right,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, ingat.
Ingat.
Well, that's it, folks. Yet another episode of FMA Talk Live in the books. Thanks again for showing the true spirit of the Mandarigma and listening to another episode of FMA Talk Live. Please like our Facebook page, subscribe to us on Stitcher and iTunes. Also, follow us at hashtag FMA Talk Live on Twitter. And don't forget to check out www.fmatalklive.com for all the latest and greatest on the show.